Welcome to Breast Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. Adjuvant systemic therapy of premenopausal women with breast cancer has many controversial facets, and one of the most challenging relates to preservation of fertility in women receiving chemotherapy. I met with Dr. Kevin Fox to discuss his research on this issue, and he began by commenting on the background to this work.
This all stemmed from the simple and long-standing observation that women who receive adjuvant chemotherapy will develop premature menopause and as a result become infertile. And it's an old observation. And we, about 1994, 1995, after kicking around some ideas with a woman at that time who was a fellow named Hallie Moore, we came across some literature from Israel where some investigators there had given leuprolide to suppress the ovaries in young women getting chemotherapy for Hodgkin's disease. And in a non-randomized clinical trial, and a piece of literature that would be probably roundly criticized for being statistically inadequate, they had suggested that they could prevent amenorrhea. So we constructed a project with the help of some fertility specialists where we did nothing more than give people concurrent leuprolide with their chemotherapy. So this was not a new idea. It was an idea that had been studied in a quasi-scientific setting only once in that Israeli study that I made reference to. We just decided to do it in an organized way. It was done very simply, and I'm still convinced that's probably the best way to do it is simply. Patients who were going to receive adjuvant chemotherapy who were premenopausal and had a particular interest in maintaining fertility were invited to enroll in this project. It was not a randomized trial. It was a pilot study of giving leuprolide concurrently with their adjuvant chemotherapy and then stopping it. And we just accrued patients at a very measured pace. We did not do this with every premenopausal woman. That was not the intent. The primary intent was to find patients who had a particular interest in preserving ovarian function. And so we would enroll patients at a rate of probably 5 or 6 per year and then began to report patients after we had what we felt was a reasonable number who had been followed for at least 1 year after the end of their chemotherapy to assess their ability to resume menstrual function. So the first objective was to see how many patients would retain or regain normal menstrual function. Of course, everybody who got leuprolide became menopausal. The chemotherapy regimens that we gave were varied, but mostly AC or AC with Taxol. A few patients had CMF. One patient had CAF. But by and large, we found that the initial cohort of 13 patients and a subsequent report of 27 patients, all patients except one resumed regular menstrual cycles, and they would do it within a median time of 5 months from the end of their chemotherapy. So the first objective had been reached. We had set an arbitrary statistical goal of regaining menstrual function in 66%. We felt that that was a reasonable number in a broad age range of patients, which ranged from about 29 to 47. We continued that project with enthusiasm. And then as time went on, we began to look at the actual fertility outcomes. And this is where it became troublesome. And this is why the project has been taken into the cooperative group setting through SWOG, where it should be. But we did not offer this outside of a randomized clinical trial to patients after 2002, because we made the observation, inaccurate as it may be, that patients who went through this process, despite regaining menstrual function, seemed to have difficulty conceiving. Now, the sticky part here is that if you ask the question, how likely should a woman be to conceive normally, that information is a little bit hard to acquire. It is an age-related phenomenon. I don't know that there's really a known figure that's known to be precise. If a woman's ability to conceive is, say, 20%, which is, of course, very low, then what would be an acceptable outcome for our patients? Well, we didn't think about this ahead of time. We were just looking at the regaining of menstrual function as our immediate measure of success. And what we observed is that in following these patients closely, out of the 27, we established what we felt was a reliable denominator of patients who were actually trying to get pregnant. And we followed their efforts over time. And to our dismay, over a follow-up period that exceeded 5 years, the success rate for patients who were trying to get pregnant was around 20%, which we felt was not acceptable.
What was the median age in that group?
Median age in that group was 38. And that is an age range where the ability to conceive probably should be greater than 20%. We did not set statistical boundaries for stopping the project based on fertility. In retrospect, we should have done that, but that's a very hard thing to do. The preliminary appearance of success based on the resumption of normal menstrual function was such that Dr. Moore, who had since moved on to the Cleveland Clinic and who is a SWOG participant, developed a clinical trial. And that clinical trial will randomize patients to receive ovarian suppression or not during their chemotherapies after the fashion that we did.
With what endpoints?
The resumption of normal menses will be the principal endpoint.
And what are the eligibility in terms of ER status?
This is for ER negative patients only.
And that was your trial also?
That ours was not. Ours was for all comers, regardless of receptor status. We took that approach because the feeling was when we initiated the project that the evidence that retaining menstrual function was necessarily detrimental to the ER-positive patient was weak. We felt that we would not put people in harm's way by enabling them to retain normal menstrual cycling. There's obviously a lot of disagreement in that matter, and when the cooperative group mechanism developed this idea, the consensus was that only estrogen receptor negative patients should be subjected to this kind of experiment because perhaps retaining menstrual function isn't such a good idea for patients who are very young in terms of the natural history of estrogen receptor positive cancers. The concern would be their relapse rates would, of course, be higher if we permitted menses to return when chemotherapy might otherwise prevent them from returning. And, of course, to take it one step further, there's a significant body of, not literature, but opinion that says that premature menopause is desirable and should be inflicted upon patients. That's too harsh a word, but should be part of the therapeutic program for very young women with estrogen receptor positive cancers, which is another issue altogether.
Yeah, and I'd like to get your thoughts on that. But getting back to the patient with ER negative tumor, it kind of makes sense to retain menstrual function in terms of total health. Although I guess theoretically you could also give the patient hormone replacement, although that's not very likely to happen.
Right. I think the secondary objectives of any study of this nature should be at least in part bone health. I think the greatest consequence of inducing premature menopause health-wise, the greatest immediate consequence is precipitous loss of bone density, which is in its own way undesirable. And this clinical trial will be able to make that observation, we hope, that retaining menstrual function, of course, preserves bone density, which it should.
Do you think that this strategy is a reasonable one to offer to a patient with an ER-negative tumor off protocol? More from the point of view of bone health and total health rather than, you know, fertility?
I'll have to say off protocol, no. We don't encourage it anymore. The reason for not doing it is, number one, out of respect for the randomized trial and the effort it's trying to make. Number two, there isn't anything that can't be fixed by other means. If you produce premature menopause, you can preserve bone health other ways. You can treat vaginal symptoms and sexual dysfunction other ways. You can treat vasomotor instability other ways. There are alternatives for symptomatic remedies for patients who have premature ovarian failure from chemotherapy. And I don't feel comfortable putting forth ovarian suppression protection as a clinical routine. And then the third element of my concern, of course, goes back to this issue of fertility. Are we fooling ourselves into thinking that these patients, just because they have normal menstrual function, means that their ovaries have been left completely intact and they will be completely capable of conceiving? And this little bit of data that we have was a little disturbing to me in the sense that people seem to have a hard time conceiving.
What do you think is going on there?
Well, you almost have to wonder if the number of follicles really is compromised. I mean, it's impossible to measure them. It's very hard to correlate it to levels of produced estrogen. It's hard to correlate it with FSH levels unless they're enormous. And my suspicion is that despite this ovarian protection, there are plenty of follicles and primordial follicles that are still completely susceptible to the cytotoxic effects of chemotherapy. And just by inducing an anovulatory state doesn't mean that you're really protecting the ovary. And some of the things that were presented this year at the ASCO meeting, I think, were very enlightening as to fertility preservation alternatives that may make this ovarian suppression strategy obsolete.
Can you talk about some of those?
Well, the things that came out of the ASCO meeting this year that I think were the most telling. First, before we discuss the issue of fertility, there has been a lot of data that's been collected through the NSABP, the B30 trial, and a project that was initiated by the late Dr. Petrick, which tries to look at the natural history of loss of menstrual function. And one of the observations that these investigators made in this, which was the first large-scale look at the effect of taxane-based chemotherapy on menstrual function, was that, as expected, the likelihood of becoming amenorrheic was age-related, which you would expect with any chemotherapy regimen. In a non-randomized setting, those who got taxanes fared a little bit worse than those who didn't get taxanes, although it's very hard to say how real that difference is. And then the most important observation of all was the reversibility of the amenorrhea. And there appeared to be, in Dr. Petrick's presentation, a plateau in amenorrhea rates after year two, but not until year two, meaning that between year one and year two, after the end of chemotherapy, a significant number of patients regained menstrual function. And I think this has implications, for example, for the application of aromatase inhibitors. If a premenopausal woman is treated with chemotherapy and becomes amenorrheic, is it appropriate to assume that she will remain in a state of real menopause? Absolutely not. At least based on this natural history information, it appears that it takes 2 years to be able to establish with some certainty that a woman is going to remain in a state of menopause.
How do you factor in age, though, in that?
The way that this project was presented in breaking patients down by age brackets still suggested that women that were, I'll say, over the age of 40 and less than the age of 50 still had a reversibility, even after the first year. It was modest, but it was definite. And I think if a woman, say, at the age of 45, who is 5 years from the mean age of menopause anyway, gets chemotherapy and becomes amenorrheic, I still don't think that we can be assured that her ovaries will remain in a state of menopause until we've followed her for 2 years. I think that's the piece of information that was given this year that I think was the most interesting and the most useful. With respect to the issue of fertility, there isn't a whole lot that has been presented in any oncologic forum about strategies to preserve fertility, but Dr. Akhtay from Cornell has been a driving force behind a particular strategy to stimulate the ovary to produce eggs for fertilization and cryopreservation. For example, we have patients diagnosed with a breast cancer, and she's desirous of subsequently having children, as she should be. His hypothesis is that you can capture the patient at the time of diagnosis before her chemotherapy is to begin, and during that time interval, you can stimulate her ovaries with, in one set of patients, tamoxifen, but in another set of patients, letrozole. And those agents, by a mechanism with which I'm completely unfamiliar, stimulates the ovary to produce eggs for fertilization. And those eggs can be retrieved in large numbers, larger numbers than an unstimulated ovary in the same patient, and can be fertilized, cryopreserved, and then implanted at a later time.
How long does that process take?
The mean time to accomplish this was measured in weeks, not in months. And the natural concern of medical oncologists, and I posed this question to Dr. Akhtay, was whether we would be precipitating unnecessary delays in the administration of chemotherapy. And he felt that this could be accomplished in one or two cycles or efforts, and those efforts take weeks rather than months. My concerns regarding delaying the initiation of chemotherapy were allayed. What we don't know yet is the fertility success rate. Those numbers are just beginning to develop. He only had about 18 months of data. The other thing that he was able to present, even though it's very early follow-up and the number of patients is relatively small, I think it's now up to over 60, was if you give patients this unusual stimulatory strategy prior to chemotherapy, will you somehow put them in harm's way? Or if you delay their chemotherapy even by a few weeks, will you put them in harm's way with respect to recurrence? And he demonstrated, I think, as convincingly as one can in a small cohort after 18 months, that there was not a precipitous increase in relapse rates during that time interval. So I think he's, at least insofar as oncologists are presented with information about this strategy, he by far has given us the most quantitatively and qualitatively interesting information of anybody out there. So it makes our ovarian suppression strategy, perhaps it looks like it may become obsolete. And I will be very interested to see his work progress rapidly over time.
We had a patient presented in one of our Meet the Professor sessions recently, which is not a rare case and a very common question that oncologists want to ask, of a woman who just got married, never had a child, had a node-negative tumor, the size was enough to normally would have received chemotherapy, who was going from oncologist to oncologist, trying to find someone who would give her therapy with hormones, because she did have an ER-positive tumor, who was comfortable not giving her chemotherapy because she was willing to accept an increased risk of relapse for the possibility of improved fertility. In patients like that, how do you present the option of chemotherapy, and are there chemotherapeutic regimens that seem to have preserved fertility more effectively that you might consider?
I think that the best information we have is that the friendliest regimen that we have with respect to producing permanent amenorrhea is probably AC. Four cycles of AC is the regimen that's been around long enough to have some accumulated experience, and in aggregate, AC chemotherapy produces less amenorrhea than CMF. And that, for the moment, is about all that we can say, except that there's a little bit of evidence now based on the ASCO presentations that taxanes may make the amenorrhea rates go up even more.
Right.
So the regimen that is among the standards that we use that I think is the least likely to produce amenorrhea is AC. The question comes up as to whether the methotrexate fluorouracil regimen, or MF, would be less likely to produce amenorrhea than AC. There isn't enough information on MF. It never really caught on after the publication of the B20 trial, although I used it a lot. But I do believe, based on the available information, if she has a node-negative estrogen receptor-positive cancer and is otherwise felt to be appropriate for chemotherapy, she should receive it, but that the MF regimen is one that is an acceptable option, which carries a theoretically low likelihood of producing amenorrhea. Under those circumstances, when preservation of fertility has been the greatest concern for the patient, then I have given methotrexate fluorouracil as per the NSABP trial B20. And I felt comfortable doing that.
You know, that kind of was perking along in my head when I saw the NSABP genomic health data looking at that study, the B20 study. And in fact, in the high recurrence score patients, the MDEF and CMF had a dramatic effect in terms of recurrence rate. Did that make you more comfortable about using MF?
I did. I never felt uncomfortable with it if preservation of ovarian function was the patient's principal concern. If that's not a concern, I haven't been in the habit of using it for a long time, only because it was a six-month regimen, involved 12 trips to the office, and life would be simpler if you could give people four cycles of AC. There was no demonstrable evidence in that clinical trial of MF's inferiority. On the other hand, there is, in the companion study of B20, if you will, B19, the study of MF versus CMF in estrogen receptor negative, node negative patients, there was a therapeutic inferiority of the MF in the younger patients. So that becomes a little bit of a more difficult issue in the patient who is estrogen receptor negative. And I have not been inclined to offer it to patients who are ER negative who are interested in fertility simply because it appears to be therapeutically subpar. But in the estrogen receptor positive patients, I have had no misgivings whatsoever.
How do you respond to patients who ask you what the effect might be in terms of pregnancy on recurrence?
The available information, which has been accumulated over the years in dribs and drabs, gives no convincing evidence whatsoever that the act of getting pregnant will increase one's rate of recurrence. I've never discouraged a patient from conception after the treatment of their breast cancer unless they're choosing to conceive at a time before the completion of their therapy. And that, of course, is those patients who are reluctant to take tamoxifen for the requisite five-year period, who would rather negotiate a shorter course of tamoxifen therapy, truncated at, say, 2 years, and then get pregnant at that point. It's not that I believe that getting pregnant in and of itself is harmful. I think that there is a detriment to shortening one's course of adjuvant hormonal therapy. I think we know that very clearly, and I do feel uncomfortable when patients try to negotiate a shorter course of tamoxifen therapy. But in answer to your question, I've never seen any convincing evidence that pregnancy per se puts one in harm's way if you have had previously diagnosed and treated early stage breast cancer.
I know your practice is weighted towards younger patients. I think most people in tertiary centers have that as a case, and plus the research that you've done. So a few questions, you know, related to that. You know, it's kind of sobering hearing you talk about using an aromatase inhibitor, tamoxifen, to stimulate ovum production. I wonder whether there's enough sensitivity out there about the issue of the need for barrier contraception in premenopausal patients. Again, one of our Meet the Professor sessions, we had a patient who got pregnant with metastatic disease, you know, a real tragedy. How do you approach this issue of counseling patients in that regard?
I would say that in our efforts to be as comprehensive in counseling patients as we can, the area in which we have done the worst job by far, again, speaking for myself, I don't want to even speak for my colleagues because it wouldn't be fair, I think I have done a poor job over the years of advising people on contraception. It's almost as though when counseling a patient who is newly diagnosed about the therapy she's going to receive, we focus too much on the issues of chemotherapy-related toxicities such as nausea, vomiting, hair loss, fatigue, cytopenia, amenorrhea, for example. And we will often neglect to caution people about conception. However, when I do remember to do it, it is a universal recommendation, and the barrier method, whatever they prefer, is about the only reasonable temporary method of conception that can be recommended. It should be recommended to all people, all women capable of conception. On chemotherapy should be, of course, advised against conception and use appropriate methods in those taking tamoxifen as well. But I think it has not been addressed consistently in all patients in whom it needs to be addressed. I find too often it's a patient-provoked question rather than a doctor-provoked answer.
What do we know about, I guess, the incidence of fetal abnormalities in conceptions that occur while patients, for example, are on tamoxifen?
There's plenty of literature about teratogenicity of tamoxifen in rodents. There is virtually no information, reliable or consistent information, about the teratogenicity in people. It's always been assumed that tamoxifen had those capabilities, and it has to be assumed to be correct. Ironically, we have a lot more information about chemotherapy's effect on fetal outcomes in pregnancy.
What do we know about that?
The MD Anderson Hospital has sort of taken the lead in this issue over the years. They published one of the first sizable series of pregnancy outcomes in patients receiving chemotherapy for early-stage breast cancer diagnosed during pregnancy, and they updated that information at the ASCO meeting. They now have accumulated a sizable number of patients. There are in excess of 50 people treated during pregnancy with either neoadjuvant or adjuvant chemotherapy. Their presentation was an excellent one because the chemotherapy was consistent along in the entire population. It was FAC. The patients generally received 4 to 6 cycles of therapy while pregnant. And of course, they were tracked for both short-term complications and slightly longer-term outcomes. This time, what they did was they actually had some information on the offspring. Now, that's a little bit hard to acquire. It requires a bit of a field exercise, I suppose, tracking down these children and then assessing their health. How does one exactly do that unless you bring them in and look them over in your own institution, and you can't really do that. So they obtained health histories primarily from the parents, and they also examined the perinatal problems the women had. And the message was that there didn't seem to be a downside to any of this. There were no unexpected mortalities for the mothers. There were no excessive perinatal morbidities or mortalities for the children. And the follow-up period, which is, as you could understand, relatively short, has revealed no unique developmental problems for these children. They did look, I think, with great scrutiny at the various perinatal and delivery complications that occurred. They looked at the comprehensive health history for as many children as they could find, and there were no recurring themes. And they presented this, I think, very eloquently and gave us all a reasonable degree of comfort that adriamycin-based chemotherapy can be given safely in the second or third trimester. I must emphasize that these patients were essentially all treated after the 12th week, and most of them treated in the third trimester.
I would assume there must be patients who've also been treated in the first trimester inadvertently or without knowing. Do we know, have any data on that?
We really don't. We've examined our own limited database for people who have become pregnant inadvertently. We were only able to find two, and in each case, termination of the pregnancy was recommended. And I think that if a patient does get treated inadvertently in the first trimester, it probably is prudent to recommend that the pregnancy be terminated.
It was interesting in this case that I was telling you about. This patient not only got chemotherapy, but also radiation therapy, had an amniocentesis, decided to have the child, actually died shortly after childbirth, and I think the child's now a couple years old and doing well. Of course, one case doesn't prove anything. That's kind of interesting. Yeah.
One of the other interesting pieces of information from the ASCO meeting, and I don't want to get off the subject here entirely, but it raised the question of the safety of the radiation exposure to the fetus for a woman getting a sentinel lymph node procedure during pregnancy. And I thought that was very compelling information. The situation obviously is going to come up. Women will be diagnosed during pregnancy and in theory should be entitled to the same surgical choices that a woman has when not pregnant. So there are some fairly obvious guidelines for exposure to radiation in utero. Therapeutic radiation for the treatment of early stage breast cancer is, of course, out of the question. It exceeds the reasonable limit of exposure to the fetus. But what they did at Memorial Sloan Kettering was they looked at patients who had undergone sentinel lymph node procedures, and through the use of anthropomorphic phantoms, they determined the dose that would likely be received to a developing fetus at various stages. And in every case, even with the highest amount of radioactivity given in the sentinel node procedure and the largest fetus, the calculated exposures were well below the boundaries of safety. Upon hearing this, I, of course, interrogated some surgeons to see what their practices were. And I actually found, to my surprise, that there are many surgeons who are well-versed in the sentinel node procedure that were quite willing to perform the procedure on a patient while pregnant. I don't know that every surgeon who does sentinel node procedures finds it to be an acceptable practice, but the recurring theme was that the surgeons that I spoke to were comfortable with the safety of the sentinel node procedure, but that the procedure could be done with technetium sulfur colloid only and not blue dye. The blue dye was contraindicated because of the potential exposure to the fetus of the blue dye.
That's interesting.
Yeah. I was corrected by everyone that I spoke to that giving blue dye to one who was pregnant would be an undesirable thing. It was more a product of the lack of knowledge about what blue dye might do. We feel safe that the radioactivity exposure to the fetus is going to be negligible, but the blue dye is an unanswerable question. So if surgeons are going to do this, and it appears, based on this information, to be acceptable, the technetium sulfur colloid should be the only thing used in the procedure.
That's fascinating. Can you provide a little bit of an update of where things are in terms of clinical research on adjuvant hormonal therapy in premenopausal patients? There are several large international trials out there right now. What are some of the questions that are being looked at?
Well, the biggest challenge, I think, in developing new therapeutic strategies for premenopausal women with hormone receptor positive breast cancers have to do entirely with the issue of ovarian suppression versus not. We are participating in one of the two largest clinical trials addressing this issue. We're participating in the SOFT trial, which is a three-way randomization of premenopausal women with receptor-positive cancers to receive tamoxifen alone, ovarian suppression for 5 years with tamoxifen, or ovarian suppression for 5 years with exemestane. I don't know that there is a more important question in the clinical research in breast cancer in younger patients at the moment. The irony is that the ability to get patients to participate in this research trial has been enormously difficult, and the accrual to the soft trial has been sluggish at best. Who's to blame? What's to blame? Perhaps we don't push the trial hard enough, but I think we have an obstacle that is just going to prove to be persistently difficult to overcome. Convincing a young woman to subject herself to 5 years of intentional ovarian suppression just doesn't have a lot of appeal to women who are just coming out of a course of chemotherapy, who are facing the uncertainty of their future and all of that. We have found it to be disconcerting for patients and have been unable to convince many young women to participate. At the same time, I still think it's a critically important question. In the recent recommendations of the summary of the 2005 St. Gallen meeting, there's a little section in the end on the treatment of premenopausal women, and it's composed in a very interesting way. It says that despite the absence of available data, the use of ovarian function suppression in premenopausal women is acceptable. Now, there's only really two ways to look at that, and one is to say, okay, it is acceptable, and the other is to say, well, perhaps in the absence of available data, it shouldn't be perceived as such. But I think the simple construct of that recommendation of that wonderful meeting just underscores the fact that this research question is enormously important, and we can only hope it'll be answered in a timely fashion. I will say that outside of a clinical trial like the SOFT trial or the TEXT trial, we have not consistently offered ovarian suppression to patients in addition to their tamoxifen therapy.
We know from patterns of care studies in medical oncologists that it is not uncommon for them to utilize ovarian suppression with tamoxifen, and for that matter, ovarian suppression with an aromatase inhibitor, particularly in patients with many positive nodes or patients with HER2-positive tumors. Do you consider that sort of an acceptable approach?
Well, my feeling is certainly it's acceptable. The downside is, I think, well understood. The upside is not understood. But acceptability notwithstanding, this is not something that we have offered to patients on a consistent basis ourselves at Penn. The simple reason is that I feel very uncomfortable with that therapeutic instrument in the absence of data to support it. It's as simple as that. Ovarian suppression is not benign therapy. It is symptomatic for patients. There's a potential to produce unrelated health problems, both subjective and objective health problems in the short term. And the truth of the matter is, there is no evidence in the literature that ovarian suppression contributes in a positive way to the outcome for any subset of patients who are also receiving chemotherapy and tamoxifen. The recent publication of the intergroup study 0101 or ECOG 5188 sort of proves this indirectly. It was a randomization of 6 months of CAF versus CAF plus Zoladex versus CAF Zoladex tamoxifen. And subset analyses notwithstanding, the general message of the study was the act of suppressing the ovaries on its own did nothing to add to the CAF with respect to patient outcomes, and the only arm in that study which seemed to perform better than any of the others was the tamoxifen arm. And this is not an endorsement for the application of tamoxifen in conjunction with ovarian suppression. The message is that the key element in the treatment of those patients was chemotherapy and tamoxifen. There have been other studies that are perhaps somewhat flawed in the sense that they didn't incorporate only estrogen receptor positive patients, where patients were assigned at random to get ovarian suppression versus none. This is a study that comes from the United Kingdom. All the patients received tamoxifen. Chemotherapy was optional, and the randomization was to get ovarian suppression or not get it. And there's, again, no evidence that the act of ovarian suppression really alters outcomes. All of the clinical trials that have tried to address this have some problems associated with them, the greatest of which is some of them have too many patients who are receptor negative and couldn't benefit from the strategy anyway. But I think that the general message is this is not a therapeutic intervention which is known to be of value in patients who are already receiving chemotherapy and already receiving tamoxifen. So outside of a clinical trial, we have just not offered this on a consistent basis.
Of course, in that ECOG trial, you mentioned the subset data looking at the younger patients and those who are continuing to menstruate. I mean, the argument is that, sure, if you look at everybody getting chemotherapy, you're not going to see anything because a great number of those, patients are going to have chemotherapy-induced menopause. If you focus just on the ones who are actively menstruating in the younger patients, maybe you would see a benefit.
And I think that's it's an excellent argument in the sense that that clinical trial sheds a little light on the ability of ovarian suppression to augment the activity of chemotherapy. The problem is it doesn't prove the same point for patients who are taking tamoxifen, as if to say the use of tamoxifen therapy may eliminate the need for or the logic of ovarian suppression. Clearly, if a woman gets six cycles of CAF and is still menstruating and declines tamoxifen therapy, just for some reason refuses to take it, then ovarian suppression is a reasonable thing to do. But in a patient in whom tamoxifen is the intended treatment, it to be the standard of care.
Flipping over to the postmenopausal patient, what are your thoughts about the aromatase inhibitor clinical trials and what it means in terms of clinical practice right now?
I think that the situation now is, if you look at and respect the data as it was set forth in those clinical trials, it is actually not that difficult. I think at the moment you have to look at patients based on where they happen to be in their course of treatment. So for starters, in the newly diagnosed patient, the patient who was diagnosed yesterday with estrogen receptor positive breast cancer who's postmenopausal, the only clinical trial currently that addresses the treatment of that patient is the ATAC trial, which I think gives irrefutable evidence that Arimidex is probably superior to tamoxifen with respect to reducing the risk of recurrence. Overall survival is another issue altogether. So for the patient who is newly diagnosed, I think that the standard of care, the available data would suggest that 5 years of an aromatase inhibitor is the best therapy.
Before you go on, what about letrozole in terms of the big study?
So the preliminary information with letrozole in the big 198 study is giving the same message. The follow-up is shorter, I guess a little over 2 years versus six in the ATAC trial. But there is an apparent reduction in the risk of recurrence that is on the order of the reduction in the risk of recurrence seen with anastrozole. I think that most of us believe them to be likely equivalent, and the preferential prescription of anastrozole at the moment is just based on more maturity of data. The second situation is the patient who is in the middle of a course of therapy. This was the International XMS Stain Group trial, and the trials of anastrozole, which were similarly constructed, really were designed to capture patients at the midpoint of a course of therapy and measure outcomes from the point of changing their treatment, randomizing them to continue the tamoxifen versus take the aromatase inhibitor for the balance of the 5-year period. And I think for the patient who is in the middle of a course of tamoxifen therapy, or the premenopausal woman who's become amenorrheic from chemotherapy, who has been on tamoxifen and amenorrheic for 2 years, it is appropriate to change them to an aromatase inhibitor. Here again, the greatest quantity of data and the most mature data is with XMS stain, and there is a smaller quantity of data and a little bit shorter follow-up with anastrozole, but both give the same message, and there's a measurable but modest reduction in the risk of recurrence with either of those aromatase inhibitors. Third situation is the patient who's completed 5 years of tamoxifen, and of course the only thing that addresses that is MA17, which shows letrozole producing, again, a small but measurable reduction in the risk of recurrence and an indication of a survival benefit in node-positive women. I think if you look at your patients with respect to where they fall in time and you follow the data such as it exists at the moment, those are the three scenarios and the three approaches I would take. The current controversy, of course, is are all of those three strategies equivalent, and I don't think there's any way to know that. And the other controversy is sequencing of tamoxifen and anastrozole a better strategy than just 5 years of an aromatase inhibitor? And there's a lot of discussion, a lot of interesting work statistically has come out of Dana-Farber Cancer Institute looking at modeling of outcomes and using the Markov model, which for most of us up to this point was a bit of a mystery, using modeling and outcomes taken from natural history studies from large cooperative group clinical trials and meta-analyses to see if a sequencing therapy might be better than 5 years of an aromatase inhibitor. And their publication would suggest that it would be, which is a fascinating hypothesis. My feeling would be, let's find out now. And so the big 198 study is the study designed really to answer that question. And at the moment, until the 198 study shows a difference in outcome for patients who receive 5 years of letrozole versus a sequence of tamoxifen and letrozole, until that clinical trial gives us that information, I still think that the standard of care, or the most acceptable thing to do for patients who are newly diagnosed, is to give them 5 years of an aromatase inhibitor. The interest in the statistical exercise notwithstanding, I still think that 5 years of an AI is that therapy which is at the moment the best thing to do for the newly diagnosed patient.
You mentioned the patient who starts out premenopausal and becomes amenorrheic on chemotherapy. You talked about 2 years of amenorrhea as determining that the patient then could safely receive an AI. I see a lot of people in practice ordering FSH, LH, estradiol levels. What are your thoughts about that?
I think we would be remiss in recommending an AI to a premenopausal woman without measuring those things. And we will do it routinely at the two-year point if the patient has been amenorrheic for a year. The definition of amenorrhea or the definition of ovarian failure is somewhat arbitrary, and I guess will always be somewhat arbitrary. The data from the natural history study of menopause that Dr. Petrick's group presented in May did suggest that amenorrhea would be persistent and irreversible beyond the second year. However, at the two-year point, if our patients have reported 2 years of amenorrhea and we are then tempted to change them, we have always tried to corroborate that information with an estradiol level and an FSH level, recognizing the occasional shortcomings of either of those measurements. But I have, in my own practice, required that a patient have non-measurable levels of estrogen and have an elevated FSH in the postmenopausal range before prescribing an AI.
Where do you see things heading in terms of sort of the next generation of clinical research questions that are going to be asked in estrogen receptor positive tumors?
Well, I think that we're going to be stuck on our current struggle with the question of ovarian suppression for a long time, I fear. I think that a subset of patients for whom there will be some interesting research questions will be the potential to use hormone therapy and trastuzumab in the absence of chemotherapy in the lower risk receptor positive HER2 positive patients. So I think the coactivity of trastuzumab and hormonal therapies is probably one of the more interesting fields at the moment. I think the concurrent use of hormonal agents and the so-called small molecule inhibitors is another area that has to be explored. We have to find out if these strategies can be used synergistically. I foresee, at least in the next 3 to 5 years, that most of our effort will be in the area of just exploring the newer agents in conjunction with hormonal therapies.
Not to get too much into the adjuvant Herceptin story, which would take a whole other interview, but I'm curious whether or not you are offering or considering trastuzumab without chemotherapy, either in the ER-positive or ER-negative patient, particularly in an older patient who you may be reluctant to give chemotherapy.
It's a really good question, and I haven't done it yet. I guess I shouldn't say I'll never do it. I've been just a little bit reluctant to do it because I wanted to sort of stay true to the clinical trials as they were presented, sort of trying to use adjuvant Herceptin in a population of patients that sort of meet the entry criteria for those various studies, acknowledging that every one of those clinical trials did use chemotherapy. I think it's a fascinating question, and I'm sure that I'll be confronted with this situation before too long. Matter of fact, I was confronted with it about 3 days ago in a woman who was 74. She had a 9-millimeter estrogen receptor positive, HER2 positive cancer, and she actually raised the issue. And I elected not to do it, the simple reason being that the benefits of Herceptin alone in that situation, of course, are unmeasurable. And I think the risks of Herceptin therapy in an older population are, I think, a little bit of a theoretical concern. There was just a hint of information from the cardiac toxicity analysis of the NSABP that there may be some age-relatedness to this phenomenon. It wasn't potent information statistically. The number of people who seemed to be in the cohort of patients with the highest cardiac risk were women over the age of 50 who had had a compromise in their ejection fraction but were still normal. And that's a natural reluctance to use Herceptin in an elderly population where the benefits are unmeasurable.
In terms of new hormonal strategies that might be looked at in the adjuvant or neoadjuvant setting, there was a lot of enthusiasm to look at fulvestrant a couple of years ago. People sort of now are kind of rethinking it, thinking about the dose and the schedule. Where do you see that heading?
I'm not sure. I think fulvestrant is trying to find a home somewhere. Personally, I don't see it finding a home through aggressive application in the neoadjuvant setting. I think we know enough about hormonal therapy in the neoadjuvant setting to know that when given, it works. It has a response rate that is considerable. I think we've actually known that for a long, long time. How it will improve patient outcomes to use new therapies in the neoadjuvant setting is not entirely clear to me. So I'm not at a point where I see, you know, enormously great things coming out of the application of fulvestrant in the adjuvant setting, but I'm also not privy to some of the research ideas in that regard.
How do you utilize fulvestrant yourself in your own practice?
Generally speaking, it's a second-line hormonal therapy for patients who have failed an AI in the metastatic setting. And it's used for patients, of course, who have compliance issues, patients who have financial issues with purchasing medications. For example, if a patient is diagnosed with metastatic breast cancer and is naive to therapy and is postmenopausal, the therapy of first choice is, generally speaking, an aromatase inhibitor. That aromatase inhibitor is usually one of the non-steroidal ones. And at the time of progression, the obvious option is whether to try the steroidal aromatase inhibitor or something like fulvestrant. And the data for the effectiveness of exemestane therapy in that setting is somewhat limited. The data for the effectiveness of fulvestrant is somewhat limited. So I think it's something of a coin flip. And my own personal preference is to give fulvestrant because I'm afraid it's nothing more than a personal bias. There was some encouraging information, however, that made it a little bit less of a personal bias that was also presented recently by the North Central Cancer Treatment Group, which was an organized phase 2 trial of fulvestrant in people who had failed an AI, information that we hadn't seen before. And in this context, the response rate to fulvestrant was measured at around 20%. And to be honest, that to me was a fairly encouraging response rate to that drug in the setting of a single failed hormonal therapy where rates of response tend to be quite modest. So based on the information from the NCCTG, I felt much more comfortable with using fulvestrant as second-line therapy.